I'm Bill Barole. Over the last few decades, I've done every kind of writing there is to do, from journalism to humor, books, movies, and television.
I'm Matt Ricardo. For the last 30 years, I've toured the world as a variety performer.
We've come together across the Atlantic to talk about creativity, what it is, where it comes from, why it matters.
Thomas Edison said, "To invent, you need a good imagination and a pile of junk."
This is Imagination and Junk, a conversation about the hard work of creativity.
Episode 19, Less.
Dear Matt, it's a lovely day in Santa Monica, and I'm sitting at my desk staring out the window through the branches of our Chinese flame tree at the blue sky beyond. There's something about this vista that always makes me feel a little nostalgic for some reason. I don't know. It's the way the sky keeps rolling past, maybe. Some message about the implacable progress of time. The older I get, the more I find myself revisiting the follies of my youth, and today, I thought about something I hadn't thought of in years, which is, when I was a very young writer, and by this I mean a very young person, maybe 12 or 13, I started writing a long political novel. I can see you shaking your head like a character in a cartoon, like, wait, a what? Yes, I was 13 or so, a voracious reader, and I was at the time in the thrall of a paperback I'd picked up somewhere by a guy named Fletcher Knebel. Knebel most famously wrote 7 Days in May, which was turned into a thriller with Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas, but he also wrote, this is the one I remember reading around then, a potboiler called Night of Camp David, about a sitting president who was clinically insane. Talk about your unlikely premises, right? I mean, like that could ever happen. Anyway, I was a kid who wanted to be a writer, and this not very good novel had the advantage of, out of all the things I'd read, being undeniably the most recent. So I thought, I can do that. So I decided to write a political novel, despite knowing nothing about how politics worked. Or, for that matter, anything else. I was 13. In the course of this effort, I wrote a chapter about a gala banquet attended by my fictional president, who I'd named something like Wesley Van Wesleyson. Yeah, I had a gift for names. And I included a bit of scene setting I must have thought was pretty neat, which was that when the president arrives at the dinner, he checks a list at the door to find out which table he's seated at. I'll wait for you to catch your breath. What's really remarkable about this recollection? Well, there are so many things. But what I'm thinking about is that I must have been an extraordinarily trusting kid, because I gave the unfinished manuscript to my father, who, I have to say, very gently pointed out that in all likelihood the President of the United States wouldn't need to check a mimeographed seating chart pushpinned to a bulletin board to figure out where his seat was at a state dinner. Right, I remember thinking. No chart. Good detail. And filed it away for a rewrite. Which never happened, probably because there was something good on TV that night. I was 13. I bring this anecdote up now not because I want you to know what a profound weirdo I was, but because it illustrates something people often do at the outset of their creative lives. I threw pretty much every thought I had at the wall. Same thing in high school and in college, where my stuff was, God help me, actually published for other people to read. I overstuffed the turkey. There's a paradox I've always found fascinating, which is that the quest of a creative life is often to get simple, to do less. An overpainted canvas is the signature of the beginner, and the longer you go, the better you get, the more tools you have in your toolbox, the less you try to do. You try to get simpler, get cleaner, do less. So let's take our text today from Jack Kerouac, who said in Some of the Dharma, completed in 1956, "Soon I'll find the right words. They'll be very simple." Couple of things about this quote, by the way. One, it is widely miscited as, "One day I will find the right words and they will be simple," which scans better but is undeniably more complex than the correct quote. So, you know, irony. And two, however he said it, the fact that it was Kerouac, one of the windiest writers who ever lived, who said this, well, this says something profound about the nature and the process of creativity. So that's what we're going to talk about in this episode, the quest for simplicity. So let me start by asking you this. When you were starting out on the road toward mastery of your craft, did you do what I did? Did you busily chuck everything you knew, or thought you knew, into the stew pot? And if so, when did you begin the long process of paring down what you brought to the stage? I'm going to go back to staring out the window now. One of the advantages of living in a two-writer household is that Jennifer knows this isn't purely a sign of indolence. One day not long ago, she stuck her head in my office door to find me listening to music, watching the news, and playing solitaire. "What are you doing?" she said. "Writing," I said. "Right," she said, and withdrew. So, back to it. Talk to you next time. Bill.
Dear Bill, all right, if we're doing this, then we're doing this. I also wrote a political thriller when I was a kid, about the same age as you were, I think. We were tasked with writing a short story for English class. And since a large percentage of my home life was taken up with my dad's absolutely justified shouty anger at the exploits of our then Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, I chose her as my main theme. My big idea was that the reader would follow what seemed to be some kind of terrorist as they broke into a venue that Thatcher was giving a televised speech at. They'd sneak backstage and we'd wonder, are they going to plant a bomb, attempt an assassination? Until finally, they'd reach a heavily guarded and hidden control room, gain entry and crash the computers that were running the robot Mrs. Thatcher. I secretly still think this is a pretty great idea, but I'd never admit it on a podcast. Anyway, simplicity. Yes, good. You ask if I, like you, put every ingredient into the soup when I was first starting out, and it's a complicated answer. Since so much of my work is dependent on learned circus and variety skills, and since when you first start out, you haven't actually had the time or the motivation to learn to do as many things as you wish you could do, it's harder to throw in too much. Does that make sense? The nature of the learning process that the building blocks of my art form requires means you have to decide what you want to learn many months away from the point at which you'll be able to actually do it. So careful consideration of how you're spending your time is kinda unavoidable. But after a while, yeah, you realise the wisdom is in paring it all down. Once I realised what my finale trick was going to be, that I could do it, that it was strong and people liked it, then I smoothed out anything that would get in the way of the momentum that carried the audience towards that big finish. Sometimes on casual inspection, my act looks like a man coming on stage, announcing he's going to do a particular trick, and then somehow spending half an hour entertainingly not doing it until finally he does. So, perhaps like a lot of things that seem artistically simple, there's actually more going on under the bonnet than it appears. Sorry, we call it a bonnet. You call it an elevator? By its very nature, as something that takes a while to learn and even longer to master, simplicity isn't simple. Perhaps the better you get as an artist, the more beauty and meaning and soul and whatever you can inject into less actual output. I just had lunch with my friend Paddy yesterday. He used to be a brilliant street performer, did his thing all over the world to huge audiences. In his act, he did one trick. He'd take some paper money from an audience member, burn it, and then bring it back. His show lasted regularly at least 40 minutes. To be able to hold an audience for that long with a very small trick using only things you're carrying in your pockets, I mean, the act was simple, but pulling that off is incredibly complicated. Leonardo da Vinci agrees with me. I always liked him, ever since his cameo in the underrated movie Hudson Hawk. Yeah, I said it. Anyway, he said, simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. It is perhaps counterintuitive. You're a maker. You want to make all the things. It feels good using lots of words or packing an act with props or having your 3-minute dance number have nothing but motion, but it's stuff for the sake of stuff sometimes. In the world of professional wrestling, yes, I'm talking about wrestling again. There's a term for this. Younger wrestlers, keen to show everything they can do as soon as they get in the ring, are told by older hands to stop trying to get all their shit in. Sometimes you can even see an older wrestler tell a newer one during a match to slow down, take their time. Because, just as with every kind of creative work, you're not there to show everything you can do, all the things you've learned. You're there to tell a story. Sometimes that story might require a backflip or a $10 phrase or a whole extra suitcase full of props, but usually not so much. Usually, a story simply told is a powerful one. Maybe you need to learn as much as you can so that at the same time you learned what was, in fact, worth learning. I was going to write one of our usual funny little sign-offs here, but maybe I'll keep it simple this week. Oh, too late. Talk to you soon, Matt.
Dear Matt, wow. We were a very specific kind of nerdy little white boy, weren't we? I shouldn't be surprised, maybe, to find out that we were so much that very particular variety of nerd. After all, we stumbled on each other in middle age, and our commonalities must have come from somewhere. But honestly, the fact that we both, at around the age when our classmates were discovering girls, chose to express our hopes, dreams, and longings via the political thriller, well, that's just weird. In a great way, I mean. Also, side note, I do wish I'd had the wit to come up with Robot Margaret Thatcher, which is not only a super cool device to hang a plot on, but would also have made an excellent name for a 1980s British punk band. So, yeah, there is, as you point out, a basic difference between your racket and mine when it comes to that quest for simplicity. Writing, at least the journalistic kind, aspires to a knife's edge clarity that encourages conciseness. It's baked into the core values of the field in a way that doesn't hold as true with the performing arts. An editor of mine at Newsweek once asked me to rewrite a series of narrative captions to give them more of a lapidary quality. Sure, I said, no problem. And then I went back to my office to look up lapidary. Now I'm going to say something that will make me sound relentlessly old media, as a troll on the internet once described me. This conciseness was much more a core value in the days of print, when there was a physical limit on the volume of space available. That value is still there, kinda, but it's more or less vestigial now, like a phantom limb, or the slight smell of smoke in a room where a candle's been extinguished. A reminder of a thing, more than the thing itself. Anyway, let's say for argument's sake, which is, after all, how we say everything around here, that the quest for simplicity applies to both writing and performing arts, because it applies in a broad way to all creative work. You can see this in all kinds of ways. You talked about the way your act appears to be a guy shambling aimlessly toward one big thing. You could argue that this apparent structure is the visible expression of simplicity. You yourself called it a smoothing out. But you could also argue, I think, that it's just the opposite of that, because what you're doing with that structure, by design, is distracting your audience with so much artfully contrived business that they don't notice you steering them toward that big thing. So, it's complicated, this notion of simplicity. It isn't a fixed target. That Newsweek editor who asked me to make my captions more lapidary, what he was really asking for was something more in the impersonal voice that the Newsweeklies favored for most of their lives, a voice that expressed its authority in a lack of writerly frills and filigrees. This was a voice that I chafed against, if you want to know the truth, and when, in the mid-80s, both Newsweek and, later, Time began to loosen up and let writers swing a little more, well, I was happily one of the beneficiaries. We've talked about the weekend in 1987 when I managed to con my editor into approving my insane idea that I should fly to Las Vegas, sit in the audience for the annual telethon of the Muscular Dystrophy Association, and write a first-person real-time account as I watched host Jerry Lewis do his annual swan dive into sleep-deprived madness. That would have been inconceivable 20 years earlier. But even then, in the peak years of what came to be called group journalism and that passive, no-frills voice, there were valuable lessons to be learned about simplicity. In his memoir, The Lead, Calvin Trillin writes about his stint as a Nation editor at Time in the early 60s, and the process by which Time stories were cut to fit the space allotted, a process that was called greening for the green pencils that were used. It was just called fitting at Newsweek. and the people who did it were ruthless professionals with little sympathy for writers and their whining about pace and rhythm. On the other hand, I did marry one of them, so I guess they weren't all bad. Trillin recalls stories he'd boiled down to the bone, to their absolute minimum, and finding on them, when they came back from his editor, the pitiless instruction, green 8 lines, or green 14 lines. And the thing is, he always managed to do it. As lapidary as he may have believed his stuff to be, there was always room to cut. Not only that, I was surprised, Trillin wrote, that what I had thought of as a tightly constructed 70-line story was unharmed or even improved by greening 10% of it. If you follow this line of logic, you end up at a story that runs exactly 0 lines, which may have been the platonic ideal of a Newsweekly story. But it raises a question. How much smoothing is too much? How do you know when you get there? As an homage to Calvin Trillin and all the Newsweekly writers who came before me, I'll just say at this point, 30. Bill.
Dear Bill. Hello, London. We are Robot Thatcher. Here's our latest single, Party in the Falklands. 1, 2, 3. Anyway. I loved your stuff about how conciseness in print journalism came from the literal amount of space available. Which, as soon as I think about it, of course it did. And that made me think about the modern world's version of that. Now, of course, on the internet, there is as much space as you could want, but the new consideration isn't space, but attention. Because everything is algorithmically controlled and delivered, there are universally agreed upon best practices for publishing online to attract people and have them stick around. At Newsweek, your readers had already bought the magazine. On the internet, it's assumed that everyone always has one foot out of the door on anything you make. That's if the maths decided to show it to them in the first place. Sorry, we say maths, you say elevator. So, as an example, on YouTube, you're advised to repeat the title of the video within the first 15 seconds of the script, and also, in that 15 seconds, create a hook that will make people want to watch for a payoff at the end. You might also want to tell them that you'll be giving them information that will benefit them later in the video. It is apparently also a good move to set up a situation of great risk so people want to stick around to see if it pays off or if you suffer in some way. And then, of course, you have to spam them with lots of calls to action and questions, which are easier to do if you're annoying half your audience and pandering to the other half, so everyone feels the need to argue in the comments section. Ooh, that'll really push the algorithm. The difference here, of course, is that none of this stuff promotes tight, effective, creative video scripts. It just makes your videos look much more like all the others. There's increased simplicity, sure, sort of, but it ain't Hemingway. Oh God, you know what? As I was writing that, I was feeling pretty smug about how none of my YouTube videos bother with any of those techniques, and then it slowly dawned on me that my cabaret act uses pretty much all of them. Let's just move on. You talking about how over time Newsweek loosened up and allowed their writers to show a little more personality and diversity of style made me think of my own art form. Journalism, boiled down to its absolute most basic form, is about conveying the important information quickly, I guess. That's useful, but not artistic, and not always interesting to read. Circus, when reduced to its pure essentials, is about displaying a skill, a feat, that those in the audience cannot do. My act, if it were presented like this, would just be 5 minutes of me running through my best tricks while a band plays the sabre dance. It does the job, but it looks like a lot of other juggling acts. It's impressive, maybe, but not particularly artistic, and certainly not funny or personal or wherever else my work sometimes strays. In the same way that a similarly reduced piece of journalism would be informative, but not carry any of the heart, brain, opinion, wit, or incisiveness of the writer. So I guess there's a line. On one side of it is useful fat cutting that threatens to move into homogenization, and on the other is artistry that risks straying into self-indulgence. And it feels like the sweet spot is to find ways to combine both extremes at the same time. For sale baby shoes never worn isn't good because it's short, and it's not good because it's heartbreakingly well written. It's good because it's both. So, Perhaps simplicity when it comes to artistic work isn't about, for want of a better word, size. It's also about style and feel and approach. This makes me think about the slow TV movement. In 2009, the Norwegian Broadcasting Corporation aired a 7-hour-long train journey, in real time. They just mounted a camera onto the front of a train and hit record. So, this is simple, right? Couldn't be more basic. Except that over the course of those 7 hours, the viewers saw everything the driver saw, which was a lot. Changing landscapes, weather, countryside, towns. By the end, they really felt like they'd travelled. So maybe simplicity in the arts isn't, simple? Talk soon. See how I made that sign off shorter, but now have made it longer? Matt.
Dear Matt. All right, angry screed incoming. Can I tell you something? I hate the phrase, talk soon. Out of all the possible ways to sign a thing off, I think talk soon is up there with please remit immediately or you'll be hearing from my attorney. It's the fake cheeriness of it that rubs me the wrong way, the lack of effort masquerading as breeziness. I mean, what, is your time so valuable that you can't spare the 2 seconds it'd take to include the words I'll, to, and you? What about the precious time you banked by writing the phrase RU as letter R, letter U? You can't use that half a second? No. What you're really doing when you say talk soon is signing off with a brisk middle finger. You can keep it. Ah, there. I feel very slightly better. Oh, wait, no, there is one more thing, and it's actually on topic. Talk soon is an example of a perfectly good declarative phrase shortened to the point where its meaning becomes murky. Are you saying, let's talk soon, thereby inviting the other party into a shared enterprise? Or are you saying, I'll talk to you soon, which has a subtly different meaning. This might seem like quibbling, but I'm actually somewhat serious here. Go with me on this. What we mean, and the differences between what we mean and what we don't, even the small differences, that's the whole ballgame in creative work. A little bit ago, I posed a question. How much simplification is too much? How do you know when you've reached a logical stopping point in smoothing out your creative work in eliminating the non-essential bits? Let me propose this. When the thing you're trying to communicate starts to get cloudier rather than clearer, you've gone too far. You made the good point that on the internet, as opposed to in print, the new coin of the realm isn't space but attention. There are, as you say, a set of widely used tricks to capture that attention from consumers. They've been codified as SEO, and boy oh boy, if you ever want to flay the skin from your body, talk to an SEO expert instead, which will affect more or less the same result in a fraction of the time. A piece of content, content being another bit of jargon I don't much care for, wow, am I crotchety today? A piece of content that's been maximized for SEO represents another example of meaning being sacrificed for efficiency. Those YouTube best practices you enumerated, the problem with them is that they sometimes subtly, sometimes with all the subtlety of a blow to the head, alter the content itself, and now I've said content again. They interpose themselves between the creator and the work. They sit on her shoulder and whisper, "Is that really what you want to say? Is that how you want to say it? You sure?" It's like the passive-aggressive roommate who looks at you on your way out to a dinner and asks, "Is that what you're wearing?" The result of questions like these can only be to instill doubt. And doubt is corrosive in creative work. However, yes, weighing down the other side of the scale is, as you suggest, the prospect of self-indulgence, of proudly elevating your own impulses to the status of rules, and ignoring the outer voices that urge you towards some measure of discipline. The trick is to ride that line. But if we're talking about creative work, and I think we still are, I know where I come down. It's on the side of impulse. If you ever have to cast a deciding vote between simplicity and indulgence, trust your impulse, because creativity is impulse. At least it is in the first instance. There's always time later to go back and reconsider, but that's a thing you can only do if you've let your flag fly in the early going. I'm sorry I never saw that 7-hour Norwegian train journey, but I've checked YouTube and there are a number of such videos available, starting with a ride from Bergen to Oslo that, if it wasn't the particular piece of video you're talking about, it might as well have been. They are, all of them, right in my wheelhouse. Or, I guess in this case, in my cab. I think I've mentioned before that during the early days of COVID, I got hooked on these long, dreamy first-person videos of guys walking around Tokyo in the rain. They were, to me, literally transporting. They picked me up out of a time and place that seemed to be coming apart at the seams and put me down somewhere else that at least looked and felt different. And if that isn't a good pocket definition of creativity, I don't know what it is. I still watch them today. I'm going to go watch one now. I'll talk to you soon. Bill.
Dear Bill. Okay, yeah, you're right about talk soon, although I'm perhaps not as incensed by it as you are. It's true, though, that it can seem to carry a variety of intentions. Is it a wish, a promise, an instruction, a prediction, a threat? You say that it's an example of too much simplification, that the clarity has become vagueness, but maybe its genius is that it's all those things at the same time. Its brevity makes the statement more powerful and certain. You might not want to. You might not look forward to it. It might be next week or in half an hour, but it will happen. Talk will occur soon. Expect it. This, of course, sent me down a rabbit hole of the various ways other people concluded their missives. They range from the affable and breezy, like Albert Einstein's, with friendly thanks and best wishes. Then there's someone like Tolkien, who would sign off with, "I trust you will find this reply satisfactory and remain yours faithfully." Not known for his brevity in prose, was Tolkien. I'm surprised his signature didn't come with a map. Or how about Leo Tolstoy's "I kiss you"? Or, for the polar opposite of that, but nearly as short as "talk soon," we turn to Raymond Chandler, who in 1945 went through a phase of signing off with, "I'm scared." Talking of being scared, let's talk SEO. I mean, let's not, obviously. I get spam emails fairly regularly from people with branded names like Dataflow Solutions and Web Reach Optimization, telling me with fizzing excitement that they can caffeinate my SEO and ensure that I'm always top of customers' search results. They often say something like, "Our team has looked at your website and found 3 mistakes you're making that are stopping you from appearing in the first page of Google search." These emails, and let me be completely clear here, make me want to track down those responsible and drown them in a sink. I mean, I won't do that, but still, I want to. The thing is, when people search for me, I am not just in the first page of Google search, I am pretty much the entire first page. I am top. I have my search engine optimized. Because when people search for me, they Google my name, and I have my name, so they find me. Oh, and don't get me started on content. Whenever my old agent and I were out on a gig or a TV show or something, and one of us would suggest we should take some photos of me doing the thing for Instagram, we would look at each other and say in a dramatically weary voice, "Content, content, content." Content is a perfect word for the internet, though. I hate it, but it's correct. Once you learn that the best and arguably only way to get traction for things you're making on the internet is to make a lot of stuff regularly, regardless of what it is or how good it is, then content starts to make sense. Online, what you're making doesn't really matter much, and how good it is, how well it's made, how much thought and soul and craft went into it, that matters even less. You want the clicks? Post something at the same time every day. That's what it takes. Content, content, content. My work on YouTube and Instagram and this podcast do not do that. We take our time and make things that we think are of some worth. We're idiots. Maybe we should call what we do discontent. But that's because we're doing this to make something people will like, rather than to score highly in the great internet video game. Although, if you do want to recommend Imagination and Junk to your friends on your social media platform of choice, we wouldn't want to stop you. And that brings us to your idea of the balance between impulse and the rules. You're right, of course, about trusting your artistic impulses over following all the rules. The fun stuff usually happens when those impulses bump up against the rules and leave a dent, or move them a bit. There's no point in having structure, unless it's there to attempt, and sometimes joyfully fail, to contain the stuff that's bubbling out of your brain. I take out my camera and point it at something when something in the back of my head that I can't quite explain tells me to. But once I do, the rules come into play. Exposure, depth of field, framing. I carefully twist that focus ring until the world through my viewfinder becomes sharp and clear, but then maybe I'll futz with some of those rules a bit. Focus on the wrong thing, frame it oddly. See what new story I can tell on top of what I can see. Make the camera add to the photo rather than just recording it. I start with the simplicity and then I knock it about a bit. Maybe sometimes find something even more simple. You've talked before about your walking around Tokyo YouTube channels, and they are hypnotic and oddly beautiful. They make me want to go back there though, which, in the spirit of the theme of this episode, simplicity, brings me to my version. During the pandemic lockdowns, I bought a VR headset, and there's this app called Wonder. It's the simplest but most magical thing. You boot it up, and then you just say, out loud, a place. And your surroundings melt away and then reform, and thanks to the software talking to Google Earth Street View, you find yourself materializing in that place. You can look around in 360 degrees. It surrounds you. For that year, when travel was off the table, to be able to slide on a magic hat and tell it to take me to a place I love and letting it convince me through electronic smoke and mirrors that I'm somewhere far away. Not even to walk around, but just to be. I swear, sometimes when I had it magic me to my favourite seaside town in Italy, I could smell the ocean in the air. I'll steal today's sign off from Hunter S. Thompson. That's it for now. Until I hear from you again, I remain your friend, Matt.
Imagination and Junk is written by Bill Barole in the US and Matt Ricardo in the UK, with audio production by Bill Barole. For more information, show notes, and bonus content, it's imaginationandjunk.com.